Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Oh, we're going to be in the report of the spies today. This is a tragic situation. But I think the nature of human beings is such that we're going to be able to see this not only in our own history, but our own lives. The walk of faith seems contradictory to everything else that our society is telling us. It is true here, too. The fallen propensities of man continue to erupt and blossom, even in areas where they should have been weeded out. Listen to this. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, now in Deuteronomy 1:22, the people come and ask him. And I'm not exactly sure how these two relate, but I don't think that there are contradictions in the Bible. That's my presupposition. So I'm sure they do relate. And send out for yourselves men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan. Now, this seems to be a way to increase their faith. But what it turns out is a test that they fail. I think from Genesis chapter 22, we learn that God is going to test his children. All the way through the Pentateuch, we've seen God testing Moses. We've heard earlier, God said, I'm going to test them in the wilderness. Well, he's going to do that. And so here he sends them in. They're going to see the problems. But God's promised to give it to them. God's promised to be with them. God is sufficient. And yet they continue to look at their resources, not God's resources. A man from every of their father's tribes, everyone a leader or a prince from among them. Now, the Levites are not included. We learn that from the list that's going to come in verses 4 through 16. And this list is very interesting because it differs from some of the other lists that we have of the princes or leaders of the tribes. Matter of fact, even the order of the tribes somewhat differ. Notice that in Numbers chapter 1 and 2 and Numbers chapter 7 is a list of the heads of the tribes. But it's a different list than here. Some have speculated that the Numbers 1 and 2 and 7 passage are the older members, older elders, older princes of the tribes, but that this passage is the younger leaders, those who are 20 years and up, but not so old they can't fight. And that seems to make sense. These are more warrior-type people as far as their task that's assigned to them. And so you see we have Reuben and Simeon and Judah begins to go down to the list of the tribes. Notice that we have in verse 8 from the tribe of Ephraim. That's where Joshua is going to come from. His name is Hoshea here, which shows his earlier name. Now, his name's going to be changed in verse 16. There's been some speculation. Hoshea means is the Hebrew word for salvation. When you add the covenant name for God, Yahweh, onto the front of it, it becomes Joshua, which is really exactly the same word as Jesus, Yahweh saves. And since from Exodus 6:3, we know that Yahweh was new to the Hebrews, or at least its true meaning, this shows the ancientness of this passage where his name was Hoshea, but the covenant name is going to be added on later when he becomes the second in command of Moses and later the successor of Moses. But what's surprising is in verse 11 it says, from the tribe of Joseph, from the tribe of Manasseh. Now there is no tribe of Joseph because Ephraim and Manasseh become the two half-tribes that take over Joseph's possession. And Joseph receives the inheritance of the firstborn, double possession. Now Judah receives the spiritual inheritance, but Joseph receives the physical inheritance, the double blessing. And so it really should be Ephraim should go down with the tribe of Joseph. And why they're split, we're just not sure. Then notice it mentions in verse 17 a geographical description of where they are to go. Then Moses sent the spies to the land of Canaan and said, go up there into the Negev. And that means the dryness, and it's used for the southern area below Beersheba. It's really an uninhabited pasture land, not enough rain to cultivate crops, but enough for desert grass to grow where animals can graze. And you'll see what the land is like, whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and how is the land of which they live, is it good or bad? How are the cities, are they like camps or fortifications? How is the land, fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? They're kind of do a geographical summary to look at the cities, look at the people, look at the fruit of the land, and come back and report. Now, notice it mentions in verse 20, now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. This is going to be late July. Now, we've compared this with chapter 10, verse 11. We know it's about two lunar periods since they left Mount Sinai. Now, it's not all that far geographically as you look from the traditional site of Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea, but we're talking about 1.5 to 3 million people. Wouldn't take very long for a small group to, but for that large group, old men, women, carts, animals, took quite a period of time. Now, of course, they're at Kadesh, which is the major oasis of the Sinai Peninsula, and they stayed there for a long period of time. So verse 21, so they went up and spied the land from the wilderness of Zin. Now look at your map in the back of your Bible. The wilderness of Zin, S-I-N, Sin, down in the southern area of the Sinai Peninsula is where Mount Sinai is. The wilderness of Zin, two different Hebrew letters, is up very much close to Kadesh Barnea. The wilderness of Paran is on the east, and the wilderness of Zin is in the middle, and the wilderness of Shur is a little more over to the west. So here they come to the wilderness of Zin, as far as Rehob at Lebo Hamath. Now we learn from the Numbers 34, verses 1 through 12, that this is very much to the north. Now, a little commentary that I like very much when it's available is the Tyndale Old Testament series. This particular one is done by Winham on Numbers. It's an excellent volume. And on page 233, gives a map of this supposed ideal boundaries of the Promised Land. And we learn that this northern place, Hamath, is north of Damascus. Now, we don't find this territory really fulfilled in the life of Israel except the reigns of David and Solomon. So I think it's this ideal boundaries of the Promised Land. Matter of fact, from later documents, we found the land of Canaan is pretty much described in these same geographical locations. So here we have a brief description, primarily going to focus around Hebron. Now, Hebron's in the south in the tribal allocation of Judah later on. It goes all the way north of Damascus, and it must have gone way up there. But it focuses around Hebron, the place they're going to enter. The first conquest they're going to have is right there in this southern Judean region. And when they have gone up to Negev, they came to Hebron. Now, here's a mention of several different people. They must have talked to some folks. Now, notice it says the descendants of Anak. Now, Anak means neck. And the idea here is of long-necked. And we learn from over here in verse 33 that they are identified with the Nephilim. Now, the Nephilim, we think, means fallen ones, though some would say tyrants. I think, personally, it goes back to Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, where angels and cohabitated with women, and giants came from that. And one of the reasons for the flood we get from 1 Enoch is that God wanted to destroy this race of half-angels and half-men. It was an attempt, to corrupt the line of the Messiah. But whether I can prove that or not, I'm not sure. So the Nephilim seem to be the giants. That's the way several translations make it. King James has giants, I believe. And so they're very tall people, like Og of Bashan, like Goliath. But they lived around the city of Hebron. Okay? Now, notice it mentions here. Now, Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan, Z-O-A-N, Zorn, in Egypt. Now, Zorn, people say Zorn. There's no R in there. It's really Tanis. Now, Tanis is that capital close to the land of Goshen. Many believe that Tanis was built by the Hyksos, those rulers that had their capital there, and then also that the same Hyksos, the shepherd kings, the Semitic rulers of Egypt for several dynasties, also built Hebron. They built both of them. So it's a way of going back to the knowledge that Moses would have. Some say it's later editor, but really I think it's something that someone who grew up in Egypt would uniquely know. But notice it mentions, and they came to the valley of Eshcol. Now we learn from verse 24 that the word cluster and the word Eshcol are the same. It's a very famous valley for growing grapes, still is. And from there they cut down a branch of a single cluster of grapes, and they carried on a pole between two men with some of the pomegranates and figs, the big grapes. The rabbis say they're really big, but the rabbis get a little wild. But I don't think it's as big as rabbinical Judaism says, but they are really big grapes. Notice verse 25. When they returned from spying out the land after forty days, and this is not precisely 40 24-hour days, but it's a kind of a way in Hebrew of saying it was longer than a month, but less than a lot of lunar cycles. So it's kind of an indefinite period of time. They proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron, all the congregation of the sons of Israel, the witness of Paran at Kadesh, and they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So we're going to report to the entire population, not just Moses privately, but the whole group. Thus they told him and said, "We went into the land that you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit." Nevertheless, this is a very strong adversative in Hebrew. Very little. Notice when it mentions this land flowing with milk and honey, they left out the characteristic phrase which the Lord your God has sworn to give in you. They just left that out. It's been repeated over and over in Numbers. They just left that out. Why? Because of this strong adversative. They're going to have but. The people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there, the giants. Amalek is living in the land. Now, Amalek is a nomadic descendant of Esau. They're going to give the Israelites miseries in the days ahead. They come from Esau, Genesis 26:12, and they're nomadic Arabs. They live in the southern part, down south of Beersheba, in the land of the Negev. That's the dryness, the south country. And the Hittites, these apparently lived around the city of Hebron. And the Jebusites, these are the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And the Amorites, these live in the hill country. Are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites live on the Sheplah, or the coastal plain, by the sea and by the side of Jordan. So they're the different geographical locations of the land of Palestine. And Caleb. Now, Caleb's interesting. His name is the Hebrew word for dog. Now, of course, dogs are not little pets. They are mongrels, but they were used either for help herding the sheep, if they're, I don't know if that's true this early, or they're not pets, that's for sure. Now, you know, he is an unusual person. It seems like, from other passages, that he is not of the tribe of Judah. It seems that he is an Edomite. Now, if you compare Numbers 32:12, he's called a Kenizzite, and Joshua 15:17, and Judges 1:13, you get that he's a Kenizzite, Kenizzite. If you take that back to Genesis 36:11 and 1 Chronicles 1:53, you get that he's a descendant of Esau, of Edom. How he was incorporated in the tribe of Judah, I'm not sure, but he sure becomes a leader. This also is kind of like Rahab. Here's a person of great faith in the midst of the people of God. It's irony. People of God are rebellious. Here's a foreigner who has more faith than the people of God, like Rahab, like Ruth. Now, notice it says, "Quiet the people before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it. Well, we will surely overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us." Now, they'd forgot the factor of God. They were looking at their own resources. Aren't you glad we never do that? Take our eyes off God and look at what we have, what's around us, the circumstantial nature of life. Isn't this what happened to Peter when he walked on the water? He took his eyes off Jesus and looked on the wind and the waters. I think we do it all the time. These folks said, "We just don't have the resources to do this." And Caleb said, "With God, we have all the resources we need to do this. His promise is involved with this. This is to fulfill His ancient promise to our fathers." And it wasn't even his fathers. So they gave at the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land is through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants." Now, this was a lie. It wasn't a land that devours. It seems to be they were just making this up. Now, this in the book of Leviticus, this kind of phrase is used several times. I think it's Leviticus 25. But really, I'm not sure that's what it really... I'm not sure this was fact. If it is fact, it seems to refer to the fact that there was a lot of internal wars, maybe, or that there was harsh natural conditions. You might want to see Leviticus 26:38 and Ezekiel 36:13. Now, was this true? Was the land bad? No, the land was fruitful. It seems they're trying to make an excuse of why they don't want to go there. And then when that didn't work, they say, and by the way, we saw the giants there, King James, men of great size, the Nephilim, the Anakim. So they're saying the land is not good, and it's got giants there, fortified cities. We can't do it. There are also the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in their own sight. Here's exaggeration. Not trust in God, but exaggeration. They weren't that tall. Notice chapter 14. Then the congregation lifted their voices and cried, and all the people wept that night. And the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Well, isn't that the characteristic pattern? They don't like what God has done. They gripe against the leaders. The whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Oh, that we had died in the wilderness." Look at verse 3. "For it would be better for us to return to Egypt." What a theological heresy. Moses and Aaron are going to be absolutely croaking this. We see the same apostasy in Numbers 11:5, Numbers 16:13, Numbers 20, verse 3, Numbers 20, verse 4, Numbers 21:5. This same grumbling. "Oh, we go back to Egypt, the good old days." The good old days were the pits. Ain't no good old days. How our memory deceives us. They were slaves in Egypt. God had provided every need they had. They disregard all of His supernatural manifestations of care and providence and love, disregard all His promise, disregarded His leaders, disregarded His ancient promise to the patriarchs and said, we're gonna go back to Egypt. It's better in Egypt than out here. Oh, croak. So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader to return to Egypt." Here they're going to disregard God's appointed leader and appoint their own. Oh, my. "Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly." Why? I think they sensed, even before the congregation saw, the coming of the presence of God, the Shekinah cloud of glory. Now, this falling on your faces in the book of Numbers particularly seems to be a way of preparing for God's judgment on somebody. You might want to see Numbers 16:4, Numbers 16:22, Numbers 16:45, Numbers 20, verse 6. "They fell on their faces before the congregation. And Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, who tore their clothes." Now here Joshua is identified with Caleb. Why didn't Joshua speak up with Caleb? Well, they may have thought that Joshua was just giving the party line since he was so closely identified with Moses. But he does join in, I think. And here he tears his clothes. More traditional sign of mourning. Mourning what? Well, I think they're going to be mourning the death of their close kinsmen who are about to happen. "And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, 'The land which we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good.'" They tried one more time together to convince. There's two witnesses, Deuteronomy 19, enough to convince them, but they wouldn't listen. "If the Lord is pleased with us, then He will bring us into the land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land, for they shall be our prey, their protection." This is the word shadow. It's kind of like when God overshadowed Mary. He was with her. This is the same idea here. The protection of this land is gone. God is with us, not with them. "Has been removed from them. The Lord is with us. Do not fear." This protection may be this supernatural angelic protection we see in the book of Daniel. I think every nation has an angel. I think it's an evil angel, but they have an angel. That's been removed. "But the congregation said to stone them with stones." Who are they going to stone? Well, apparently Joshua and Caleb, Moses and Aaron. They're going to kill the only men of faith there. Yeah. It's exactly what's going to happen to Jeremiah. The people of Israel who were left in the land took him to Egypt, and then when he told them God's truth, they killed him down there. Isn't that just like us? Oh, we want to hear the Word of God. Tell us the Word of God. We hear it, and we want to kill those who tell us. It's amazing, but it's so true. "The glory of the Lord came. The Lord said to Moses, 'How long will this people spurn me? How long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them. I will make you a nation greater and mightier than they.'" Well, now here is God's testing Moses. Moses has been fed up too. Moses could have said, "I think you're right. Wipe them out. We'll start over." But he knows that's not true. That's not the way God works. I don't think this is God's attitude so much as God testing Moses like this. Moses offers some of the most beautiful intercessory prayers for his people. He really sees himself as a priest on their behalf, approaching God for man, as well as a prophet approaching man for God. Moses uniquely fulfills the office of priest and prophet in a unique way. So here's that beautiful intercessory prayer. And it's based on who God is. It's based on God's reputation, not on any merit of the Hebrews. They had no merit. Look at their lives. That's why God's love shows so beautifully in this history. Repeated failure, God's repeated fidelity and love. Now, notice that in verse 18, we have a description of the nature of God. "He is slow to anger, abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgressions, but He will no wise clear the guilty, visiting iniquity of the fathers, the children, the third and fourth generation." Now, there's two other beautiful passages where the character of God is seen. One is Exodus 34, 6 and 7, and one is Nehemiah 9, 17. Now, slow to anger, what does that mean? That means he has patience with us. In Psalms 103, it says, he will not be angry forever. Now, that's been interpreted that God will get mad and throw us off. But in the context, it's saying exactly the opposite. He does get mad at us because of our rebellion, but he won't stay mad. He won't stay rebellious. He won't stay obstinate against us. He'll relent, if I can use that anthropomorphic term for God. So he's slow to anger, and then he's quick to get over it. He's abundant, and the word here is hesed. It means steadfast covenant loyalty. He's going to stick to what he's promised because of who he is. Forgiving iniquity and transgression. He really does forgive and forget. He will by no means clear the guilty. He's just. Now, what is this to the third and fourth generations? Well, in Deuteronomy 5, verse 9, it's part of the Ten Commandments, the visiting iniquity. Now, some say it's lifestyle propensities passed on. I've been doing some study in the area of the demonic, and this may be the idea of familiar spirits passed on through families. There is some evidence, not so much biblical, unless it's these verses like this, as it is practical, that sin of past generations opens current generations to the presence of supernatural evil. If that's what it's referring to, and it might be, remember used to in baptismal form we said, I renounce all the works of the devil? That was the ancient church's way of trying to stop this inherited evil through families. We don't do that anymore, maybe we should. But I like the other side of this. If it's to the third and fourth generation of God's anger and justice and the consequences of sin, look at Deuteronomy 7, 9. It's to the thousandth generations of those who love Him and serve Him. Oh, my. Now, that's the character of God. Thousand generation of love versus three or four generations of wrath. Now, there you see the balance. Isaiah once says of God, God's judgment is His strange work. Now, the character of God is not in let's wipe them out, Moses, and start over with you. The character of God is what Moses says here in verse 18. I think that's very, very important. We see that. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to thy greatness, not their deserve, not their greatness, your greatness. But I want to tell you, biblical faith is the undeserved, unmerited love of God. Notice it says, thy loving kindness. He brings in Egypt here. If you don't do it, Egypt will not understand the theological truth that you're trying to give them. The Lord said, I have pardoned them according to your word. Oh, my, God forgives through Moses. But notice this, friends, the consequence of their sin is in verses 21 through 25. That's so true. God can forgive and forget, but the consequence of our sin moves through time. Isn't that what the passage about to the third and fourth generation saying? God can forgive the spiritual consequences, but sin runs its course. God, help us. All of us carry scars from our foolishness. Now, notice it says, God says, indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. For this I live is an oath formula. It's used again down in verse 28. I really believe it's from the covenant name for God, Yahweh, which is from the Hebrew verb to be, which I think means the ever-living, only-living God. He's swearing by himself. What more powerful can he swear by? All men who, surely all the men who have seen my glory, my signs, which I perform in Egypt in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times, kind of a symbol for many times, and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land. Now, this is picked up on in Hebrews chapter 4, which I swore to their fathers. This whole generation is going to die. If you look at verse 37, it seems that those spies who gave a false report, they apparently died immediately from some kind of supernatural plague that fell on them right then. And then the rest of the people are going to die before their children can inherit the land. And that's kind of irony, because basically they said our children are going to be prey to these folks. No, they're going to be the possessors of the land that you refused by faith to enter into. Notice it mentions here his servant Caleb, who had a different spirit. And this is not the idea of the Holy Spirit. It's his human spirit spoken of, who has followed me fully. Oh, what a wonderful scriptural reference to a man. Him and Joshua are going to enter. Not even Aaron or Moses are going to enter. And I shall bring him to the land which he entered. His descendants shall take possession of it. We learn from Deuteronomy 1:36 and later on in Joshua that Caleb is going to take this very area of Hebron where the giants are for his possession. Boy. Now in verse 25, they're told to turn around and go back toward Egypt. It's kind of irony. They wanted to go back to Egypt. They're going to have to go back that way in the judgment of God for 40 years. And the Lord spoke to Aaron and Moses, saying, "How long shall I bear this evil?" Now, this is a kind of a summary again, verses 36 through 35. Goes over the same number of things. Really kind of a repeat. This is not a sign of another source being combined. This is a characteristic of Hebrew literature that it goes back over it and over it again. Apparently, it's a way of helping them remember it. Notice in verse 33, "The son shall be shepherd for 40 years in the wilderness, suffer for your unfaithfulness." And the word here is whoredoms. They went spiritual whoring after other gods is usually how it's used. Here they just didn't believe in Yahweh. And here we have the aspect of the results of that. Notice it mentions a year for every day of the spies went into the land. Now, dispensationalists use this as a key to prophecy. But this is not talking about all prophecy. It's just this one judgment. You can't extrapolate this to all a day of a year. That theory just won't work, I don't think. It's reading too much into the Bible to make our theories fit, not to interpret the Bible. "I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely I will do this." Now, this is the key to all of our promises. God said it, that settles it. It is the nature of our faith. We trust God because He said He would do this or that. Folks, that's what biblical faith is all about, taking God at His word. God says, I'm just. You can depend on me. What I say, I'll do. Wow. Hallelujah. Verse 37 is the plague that falls on the spies themselves, the other 10 that are going to die. Now, listen, verse 39 through 45, God help us. What are they going to do? They're going to say, "Oh, Moses, you're right. We didn't do good. But we've repented now, and we're going to take the land by faith." Moses said, "Don't do that. You've been judged. You've got 40-year sentence now on you. You've got to go through that." They said, "Oh, no, God, we're going to do it. We're going to do it, God. Watch." So Moses didn't leave the camp. The Ark of the Covenant didn't leave the camp. But some of these rash young men went up and tried to take the land. They attacked right the area they were going to originally go. And they got the hound beat out of them. Why? Face the difference. Friends, we can do anything with God. We can't do anything without Him. This was an act of rebellion, not an act of faith anymore. Sometimes our faith is really presumption. That's what it has here. You say, "Well, Bob, how do you know just from presumption and faith?" I'm not always sure I do know. But I want to tell you this. There is that which is not issue in faith, but looks spiritual. Be careful of that. When God speaks, we must listen to Him. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place next week. God bless you.